Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. This week is my final interview that I recorded while I was at Consensus in New York and is with Trevor Kverko, the CEO of Polymath. Before I begin, and for full transparency, as some of you know, I am an investor in Polymath. I bought the token. I really like the project. It is something I am very excited about. And because of that, I did reach out to Trevor and said, I will be in New York. Could you meet for an interview? Which he was happy to do. But yeah, you should know I am an investor in the token. One of the reasons being is that while crypto and blockchain technology is very exciting, we are still to see a real killer application, ones that are used at mass scale. I know things are growing. And sometimes, you know, like with the dot-com era, I don't think people really thought it would be search and social. I think people thought it'd be e-commerce. And perhaps here with blockchain and crypto, it will be something else that we hadn't prepared for. And I think asset tokenization and security tokens are actually a big potential for the technology. So yes, I'm very excited about it. I'm excited the way it modernizes existing systems and processes for raising capital and issuing shares. But I also like the way it creates more of a level playing field for investors, in that if you raise money in crypto for a project, you're opened up to a quite wide and broad liquidity pool of investors from all over the world. So I think it's very, very exciting. There's still lots of things for it to be solved. I think you'll find with the interview, I do have some questions for Trevor. I think the primary one is going to be around liquidity for trading tokens. But, you know, I don't think that'll be a problem. I think that will be solved. So yes, Polymath is something I'm very interested in, and I intend to hold my investment for quite some time. Few other things to update you on. So I've started work on my own project, a platform which I'm working on, which is kind of exciting. I tweeted out quite a while ago that I don't really read white papers, which upset a few people. Sorry, but I don't. The reason being is they are often really too long. I just don't have the time to read a 50, 60 page white paper to understand what the project is about. And often I find it quite, you know, some of them are really technical and it's really hard to understand it. So I often do my research elsewhere and look at other resources. And in doing so, I'm also finding contradictory opinions on projects. So I have decided to work on a platform which will help investors research projects. So this platform is going to be called Open Paper. I'm currently working on a very limited test MVP, which will allow users to review white papers, highlight parts of the text and create discussions, also create TLDRs around the white papers for those who have a limited amount of time. It's very early days. I don't know how it will do, but you know, I'm going to give it a go, see what happens. Should have a first test product out in a couple of weeks. It is going to be invite only. I want to avoid shillers and I want to avoid spammers. So it's going to be an invite only platform, certainly for the early days. So if you're interested in what I'm doing here, if you want to take a look, please do head over to www.openpaper.io, where you can register for beta access. And you can also join the Telegram group I've created, where I will be sharing updates. And I'll be doing that quite transparently and open to new ideas from anyone. So yeah, please head on over there. And then there's a couple of other ideas I'm kind of working on. So one is for another odd podcast. I'm running with the idea of The Outliers, although I know there's a book being created of a similar name, but that's kind of the general idea. I kind of want to do some interviews which are a bit broader than crypto. I've been lucky to meet some great people. And, you know, I really enjoyed my interview with Lynn Albrecht, which wasn't really about crypto, even though Bitcoin was to do with the Silk Road. So I want to do a few more of those. So that will be a separate project. I'm going to share that out. I hope you might be interested in that. The working title website is www.theoutlierspodcast.com. Go there if you would like to register interest. I might keep the name, might not. And I am also potentially working on a documentary, which I can't talk about too much now, but could be quite exciting. Apart from that, please do support the show if you like it, if you love the show, if you listen to it regularly and you want to help out, please do head over to iTunes and leave us a review. It really does help with our listing. 5 stars, hopefully, if you think it deserves it. Follow me on social media. I do use that to spread the reach of what I'm doing. It's very, very helpful to me. So I'm on Twitter, Medium, Instagram. I'm at What Bitcoin Did on everything. And if you reach out to me, I will most likely reply to you. You can head over to my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com, where you can see my blog, a couple of articles I'm working on at the moment to get out soon, and you can also access my training course. And also, you can share the podcast out with your friends or family on social media. I know lots of you do this, and every single time, I really appreciate it. Okay, so I've spoken for way too long there, so let's go on to the interview with Trevor. I hope you enjoy it. It is a bit shorter than most interviews, as Trevor had a limited amount of time because he was so busy at Consensus. So I do hope in the future I will be able to catch up with him and do it again sometime. If you have any questions, you can email me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I pretty much reply to everyone. So yeah, if you've got any questions, feel free to drop me an email. Okay, I hope you enjoy the show. Hi Trevor, how are you?
I'm amazing. Yeah, I got the energy going from this crazy week so far. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for doing this.
What have you got out of the conference so far?
You know, it's like 3-4 days of just mayhem. Everybody is excited. There's a good buzz, good energy in the air. Lots of deals getting made. Lots of pitches. This is kind of the mecca of crypto right now. Everybody who is relevant pretty much is in the building.
Right. I said to you before we start, I'm not going to do the origin stuff because we've got a certain amount of time.
It all started back in...
But I've got so many questions for you. I put out a couple of tweets before, earlier today. Beyond Bitcoin, it's the single most project I'm most excited about from everything I've looked at because of the use case and the size of the market. And also, I put a bold prediction that I think you'll be a top 10 market cap coin, which I know is a bold prediction, and could even see you taken out of Ethereum. What gets you so excited about this sector?
It's a very ambitious project. We have made no mistake about that. But it just started, you know, not to get into the origin story, but it's very organic. It started just of us trying to solve our own problem, and we realized that there's just this massive opportunity. And we've been crypto people for 6, 7, 8 years now from the very beginning, and it just is such a natural use case. Financial products, Wall Street function better as tokens. And we think the world will be a better place as we continue to distribute this technology.
Okay. So I had a play with the platform this morning, various bits of experience, things I liked and things I didn't entirely get my head around. So I've got a few questions around it. But can you first explain what the ST20 token is for anybody who won't know or wouldn't have heard of it just yet?
ST20 is our standard, and without getting in too deeply into the mechanics, it's a way for us to kind of tell the world that this is how we think a proper security token should be done. And the core of ST20 is we built a way that seamlessly excludes and restricts non-accredited and non-authorized investors from holding a token. And this is even more regulatory friendly than the current scheme, which has, you know, share certificates collecting dust in a filing cabinet a lot of times. That's what ownership means. What we're saying is no, tokens are a superior way and format to own something. Tokens are programmable, and you can do interesting things on tokens, like automate certain back office functions like proxy voting, dividends, and even KYC. You can actually put identity in the smart contract itself, and that's something that we've tried to standardize with ST20.
So I'm going to jump forward because that brought up a couple of things, questions I had. How do you enforce who can own the token?
Well, technically speaking, in a literal sense, we programmatically restrict non-authorized investors from trading. But I think the point you're getting at is our network. And that's kind of what we're innovating on, is taking KYC, know your customer. It's also known in some countries as broker dealership, some kind of gatekeeper for who is who they say they are. There's a lot of very strict regulations, especially in the US, about this. What we're saying is we want to decentralize that. We want a network of independent KYC providers, some may be well-known, some not. But they're the gatekeepers that decide which Ethereum address is attached to which identity. And that's the key for, in my opinion, for security tokens to really become mainstream. To date, no one's been able to solve that problem of restricting unauthorized people from holding tokens, whether that's AML issues like anti-terrorism, anti-money laundering things, or whether that's just accreditation status. Are you rich enough to own this token? And that's just a very important legislative kind of fact of global capital markets. And the reality is a lot of these regulators, even though they're different and they have their own nuances, there's kind of common denominators between all of them. And we built the SG20 standard with those things in mind.
Right. So if I was to hold an SG20 token and I tried to transfer it to another Ethereum address, it wouldn't be able to be transferred if they're not accredited.
If you're not on the white list,
yeah,
that the issuer manages, so mm-hmm. the person that's raising money, launching the token, they're the ones with guidance from their legal counsels, with help from their KYC provider, they're the ones who maintain and upkeep this quote-unquote white list, which lives on a smart contract, which dictates who's allowed to hold the token and who's not.
But the ability to transfer isn't there, then it would fail. If
it would just not, yeah, nothing okay. would happen.
Because the other question I had then is also, is there any risk here with theft in a way? It seems like you've got less risk of theft and hacks of tokens as you would have with, say, standard kind of crypto, Ethereum, Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting discussion. I mean, that's a custody question, is who is in control of the private keys? And there's kind of a, not a debate, it's more like a continuum of you have convenience on one side. So that's like Coinbase holding your private keys, but then like, you don't have to store them, you don't mm-hmm. have to secure them. And on the other side, it's like taking a very deep security protocol of cold storage and private key management and multi-sig. So the bottom line is it's up to the user, it's up to the issuer how they want to manage that. We're also looking at insured third-party custodians who can help our bigger institutional clients store their crypto in a secure way. But generally speaking, this is kind of an evolving aspect of the security token ecosystem.
Okay. What is the potential size of the market for this?
Yeah, I say, you know, pick a number between 1 and 100 and put trillion next to it. And that's the size. It's really any financial product, pretty much top to bottom, in my opinion, functions better as a token than it does in its current legacy state. And stocks, bonds, real estate, mortgages, derivatives, we're talking really an unlimited market cap. There's no point of me just saying quadrillion. It's just kind of meaningless, but big enough for some serious improvements and disruption in the current financial apparatus.
It seems like one of the best real use cases. And that we have a lot of these utility tokens where we're yet to find out if they're going to be economically profitable and if they're going to work. It was one of the things I was chatting to somebody about recently was with the dawn of the internet, everyone just thought it was e-commerce and people didn't foresee search and social being the thing to actually drive the internet forward. And it feels like with this, you've actually found an actual use case where you can save people money, you can make things more efficient.
Yeah, no, absolutely. to kind of add to that, there's a few different things going on. There's efficiencies, you know, there's running your business more efficiently, saving money, automating your back office. Like I said, smart contracts are a lot better than, you know, other financial kind of infrastructure things like settlements and clearing and KYC even. But at the end of the day, what we've noticed is that there's a couple main reasons why an entrepreneur or a business or an issuer would want to tokenize an asset or launch a token in exchange for capital. And actually, let me just make another point on that is there's two types of use cases that we're seeing. There's, I already have an asset. I have a house. I have a real estate fund. I have artwork. I have whatever. And I want to tokenize it in its existing form and then enjoy the benefits tokens have over the current share structure. The other way, and this is the way that we're kind of focusing on to start, is you have an idea. You have maybe an existing business, or maybe you have a structure for a fund that you want to launch. You would come to Polymath, launch your token, and then issue it in exchange for capital. So you would use it as a way to fundraise. And that kind of ties back to my earlier point, is that the real go-to market strategy that we've learned by talking to people for the last 2 years every day is they like money, they like capital, they want a new way to fundraise. Right now, fundraising is a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. And with crypto, you know, the market, I admit, is a little frothy. But at the end of the day, the issuers are looking for the lowest cost of capital. Mm-hmm. And this is a brand new way for them to access today, $500 billion of new wealth that has been created. And we see that number only growing, especially as kind of big institutions come into the market.
Right. So could you also see that this would then also potentially be a competitor to the likes of Kickstarter and GoFundMe, and that you can fund any kind of project, whether, because it seems like, yes, you've got the real estate covered and you've got share structures of businesses, but actually, could you raise money for anything on this?
You know, look at Ethereum as a great example. People compare us to kind of Goldman Sachs and sometimes like an exchange a lot. But I like to be compared more with Ethereum. Mm-hmm. Ethereum, we're very inspired by. They are from our hometown, and they did an amazing job kind of launching this new revolution. And what Ethereum did is it made it easy. This is not what they pitched it as. It was pitched as, I don't know if you remember back in the day, they were wearing t-shirts that said, you know, decentralized Uber on the front, and then one line of code on the back, which would kind of indicate you could easily decentralize Uber. Now, I'm not saying that's not still going to happen, but what's interesting to me is that the go-to-market use case of Ethereum has been money. It's been a way for new ideas to fundraise. And Ethereum essentially is a open source, white labelable technology. Mm-hmm. So you can take ERC-20 and you can like label a brand around it and tweak it maybe in a few ways to have some kind of novel innovation and then go to market. And I think that strategy is actually even more applicable in the securities realm, because securities is all about fundraising. That's Wall Street, all these buildings. It's all about the flow of money, about mm-hmm. investment bankers raising from institutions, taking companies public. And I think the blockchain in and of itself is just a new way for programmable money to circulate through the system.
It kind of makes money more fluid.
Absolutely, yeah.
I also, one thing I noted that's probably quite good for what you're doing is that there's a lot of pressures on scaling at the moment. We've seen that with Bitcoin. And we've seen now with Ethereum, they've got issues on scaling with building dApps. But I guess with you don't have to worry about transactions per second so much, really.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, and a lot of people don't understand that. I do have some opinions on scaling. I actually just had a lunch with a guy named Jeffrey Sprecher, say his name right, of the New York Stock Exchange. And scaling is a big thing for him, because he's thinking, you know, if we're going to leverage blockchain, we got to do thousands or if not tens of thousands transactions per second. And Bitcoin does like 5 or 10 or something. So yeah, I get it for like high frequency stuff, for payments. It's definitely a consideration. I honestly think it's going to be solved. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a matter of if, not when. We have, like, take Ethereum. It's got by far the biggest network of developers volunteering their time. These are some of the smartest people mm-hmm. in the world thinking about this problem. And look at all the solutions and proposals out there with Raiden and Lightning with Bitcoin, sharding. Like mm-hmm. there's literally dozens of new proposals out there. So it's going to happen. And if anyone's going to do it, I think Ethereum has the best chance. They have kind of the first mover advantage in a way, and they have this kind of network effect where, and moat in a sense, like all like Etherscan, all these OTC markets, all these wallets, like they already have ERC-20 and Ethereum baked in. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be hard for even a slightly faster technology to get that same kind of traction. So.
But it's not something that you guys have to, it's not going to hold back what you do, the scaling.
No, and my kind of vision for this has always been to be blockchain agnostic. And now we're seeing a lot of other exciting kind of interoperability layers coming out, like Aon and Polkadot and Rootstock, and they're kind of tying a lot of these chains together. So it might become a moot point in the future where the chain is kind of irrelevant. But at the end of the day, we'll do what's best for the community. In a lot of ways, the community drives the decisions of Polymath and also our users. So our issuers, our investors, our KYC providers, our legal professionals, everyone within the network is going to have a say on what chain to use and what chain not to use.
Okay. So I had a go this morning. I'm going to talk you through my experience and then some thoughts I had. So the overriding feeling I had is that there's probably businesses that can be spun off this who can actually help companies set up in use the system, because even using something like MetaMask is going to be quite complicated for some people who want to have a to issue tokens from it. Do you foresee companies becoming almost consultancies or service providers, or are you intending Polymath to have a professional services section?
Yeah, no. So just a couple things on that note is we, when we launched earlier this year, we launched the protocol. We launched the back end. It was live. It was out in the wild, and the token was powering the network. So back in those days, you know, it was hard to use. Like, there was no interface. It's kind of the way ERC-20 is. Like, you just have like a GitHub repository and you go from there. So for us, we thought it was important to build interfaces, and we call it an application layer on top of the base layer that makes it for people to, it makes it easy for people to interact with the back end. So just a very obvious analogy is, you know, iOS. It's a very elegant way that your grandma can use the software. She can just point and click, and then the thing does what you'd expect it to do. So we take pride in that. We want to be known as the best UX innovators and distributors in blockchain, because we know guys and girls on Wall Street are not necessarily developers, and they're not going to know how to learn Solidity or learn, you know, Python or Node.js. They're going to have to you know, use a layer like the ones we're building to interact with blockchain. So we're very big on distributing our technology through really elegant interfaces.
Okay.
And I should also say that this interface they use today, so this was, we literally launched in time for Consensus for the announcement on stage. We got it out the door. This is the first iteration of what our front end interface will look like. So it all works. Mm-hmm. It all interacts with blockchain. There's still, you know, necessary things like using MetaMask, which is, you know, a browser extension to communicate with the blockchain. And those things over time, I think, will get smoothed out. But right now it's a reality.
Yeah, no, I'm assuming there's a lot more to come. So I don't think, I'm not sure that really answered my point. What I was saying is, say a fund wants to use Polymath. They want to create a security token on there. They may come to it and think, right, this is quite complicated in terms of setting up and using it. They might not be tech people. They might not be crypto. Yep. Is that a service that you might provide as a professional service, or do you see businesses actually providing professional services?
No, totally, totally understood. So with one quick point before that is we know the hard way without something like this, it's even harder to do a token launch. Uh-huh. You have to do all the legal, you have to do all the tech, you have to do all the biz dev and all the marketing. So the alternative to using an interface like the one we released today is, you know, saving time and money and headaches by using this kind of wizard, this step-by-step guide. But absolutely, just to cut to the chase of your question, we're encouraging and partnering. We have signed deals with, I'd say, dozens of partners at this point. Some are agencies, some are advisory businesses, some are exchanges, some are marketing firms. And part of kind of our interface is building a dashboard. You might not have gotten to that part in the process where you can actually apply with one click to some of our partners that can help with various aspects of this.
Yeah, no, I saw that. I was almost thinking it's the step before that, that's the person that guides you through the whole process, because they could sit in their office and set it up, but they might want somebody to do it for them and manage it for them. Almost like you get a web development company to build your website. You might have somebody to, what I saw is it's potential agencies or consultants who actually help them run the process.
Yep.
Almost like you've got companies help run ICOs now.
To be clear on that, we call them quarterbacks internally. So they kind of quarterback the deal. And you're absolutely right. That's a very crucial aspect of doing a successful sale, is finding, you know, some that exist today. Element Group, we're close with, they're great. DNA Group, they're both out of LA. And those are people that kind of say, come to us and we'll like quarterback, we'll like oversee your sale. And that's exactly what we intend to do, is have kind of as one of the first steps, apply to some of the reputable advisory businesses, launch, here's your pitch deck, try to get approved. And then once they do, the advisory businesses holds the issuer's hand throughout the process. I should also say we have our own internal advisory doing just that as well, called Matador. And this is an arm's length business that's sole job is to help high profile issuers it's like training wheels, getting them through the process, because they might get a little intimidated with some of the decentralized parts.
One of the things, I don't know why, I imagined the interface would have legal frameworks for what you're doing baked into it. But actually, it really is it's a platform for the token, but you actually have to choose the partners to work with. Mm-hmm. So for someone like me who doesn't understand, is that because you can't create a wizard for the legal structure of a token? Does everything have to have full documentation and lawyers?
You can, you know, it's something we're definitely working on,
right.
The community is working on. Lawyers have been kind of anointed as gatekeepers by government, and you need counsel and you need privilege and you need all these things to do pretty much anything in finance. So what we're doing is we're actually working with law firms to streamline that process even more and to create templates. This is all in our white paper, mm-hmm. and making it so that our native token Poly incentivizes all these independent third parties to take action towards a common goal. So whether that's the KYC provider, the issuer, the investor, the legal professional. So we want to decentralize that as well. And some top tier law firms have already indicated they're willing to work with us in fleshing out these templates. And it's good for them too, because it's another revenue stream. They can potentially service more clients. You know, it's very inefficient when they have to have all these 10-hour long meetings for every single client. Whereas if you just have a very streamlined process, maybe on a platform like Polymath, they can get a lot more clients as well.
Yeah. So one of the things I thought also would be quite interesting is, obviously, there's a lot of documentation around the legal side if somebody wants to issue a token. Do you envisage a scenario where the people investing in the token would also have an interface to log in to access documentation, almost like a old school extranet?
No, the investor portal is absolutely something. We're working with some really qualified people to build out our investor portal. I should point out, you know, there's a lot going on Polymath, but there's kind of two aspects of our organization. We have the core protocol team, which is working on the base layer, the back end, mm-hmm. and making this whitelisting concept we have commercialized and stable, and that's all they do. And then we have another side to the business, which is building interfaces on top of that. So that's like the investor portal, integrating with service providers, launching the token point and click. That's not really decentralized tech. That's interfaces. That's building stuff on top of the blockchain. So a lot of the stuff we're talking about today is the latter, is our Toronto team that's building all these interfaces that interact with the protocol. But absolutely, we intend to be rolling out a lot of portals and all the, we have a lot of different stakeholders in our ecosystem. So all of them need their own kind of custom tools and software. Mm-hmm. And one by one, we're creating it for them.
I guess my questions are just pointing to areas of your roadmap. So when I created my Peakcoin, I noticed there is a network of providers. That's very cool. How is that working out? And how are you, are people coming to you, or are you marketing out to them? Is there a lot of interest?
Yeah. You know, I should say part of the inspiration behind this wizard or dashboard, as we call it, that you did, is we have just this pent up lineup of really high quality demand. And we don't know what to do with it. We've had thousands and tens of thousands of businesses and issuers sign up saying they want to launch a token. So what we had to do is figure out, how can we create a scalable way and an automated way for people to create a token in a self-serve way? We do not want to become a Goldman Sachs. We don't want to become a service business. We want to become a decentralized technology company. So that means we have to find ways to service all these people in an efficient way. So everything we do is around, how can we process as many, how can we launch as many security tokens as we can? We have three main metrics at the firm internally. One is how many ST20 tokens have we launched? Two is how many dollars worth of crypto have been raised on those tokens?
Okay.
And three is, what is the daily volume of all of the tokens within the Polymath network?
Okay.
So those are the three keys to our success. And look, we're not the issuer per se. We're just the technology layer. Uh-huh. But this is kind of how we track the health of the ecosystem. Just like someone looking whether to invest in or purchase an Ethereum token might look at how robust is the ICOs on Ethereum. And that's like a data point they would use to help make their decision.
Have any actually been launched yet on the platform?
No, yeah, just the token wizard that you looked at today is kind of us launching our official testnet.
Okay.
And we're also kind of working concurrently with a lot of issuers through the process through our advisory business.
Uh-huh.
So you can expect a batch of them to be released in the near future.
And when do you think you will go live with your mainnet?
You know, we don't have an exact date right now, but we've been kind of working because we have the protocol layer baked out and working well. It's not going to take a super long time. So I'll get back to you with an official date when we're ready to announce.
Brilliant. I mean, people can keep an eye on that anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So the next question I had is when I went created my token, I had my options to raise in ETH and Poly. So is there any plan to make that wider to allow other, you know, could you raise in Bitcoin on it?
You know, yeah, we want to really remove friction whenever we can. And the issuer is the one that we're obsessed with serving. I think ultimately we want our native token Poly to become kind of a currency within the ecosystem. And just like when people raise Ether for their sale and they have to go buy it on the open market to participate, that's something we're looking at potentially kind of encouraging our issuers and our investors on the network to use. And we think we have a few tweaks of how raising a round in Poly makes more sense than raising it in Ether. And
why is that?
Well, our token, if you look at what ERC-20 is, it's a set of six functions. And it wasn't really proposed by the Ethereum Foundation directly. It was a community-driven thing. A guy named Fabian Vogelsteller out of Germany said, hey, we should probably agree on some set standards that we can agree on. And then sure enough, the community adopted it. And what we've done is we've taken kind of those six core functions and added several others of our own that are more amenable to security tokens. If you look at kind of Vitalik, the genius that he is, he didn't necessarily create Ethereum to help businesses raise cash. Like that could have been one use case. But that's exactly what we're focused on is kind of the B2B use case. And that means we had to kind of modify a bit of the smart contract that tokens launch on top of. So for us, we think that those additional functions that we've created mesh well with securities regulations globally. It's the ability to restrict who can hold the token. And that's one of the reasons I think people will consider raising in Poly.
Interesting. One of the things that came to mind when I was looking at it is actually I could, as it's moved into a more regulated market, one thing I think some people might struggle with is volatility in crypto, which we haven't got away from yet. And I could see some people potentially wanting a stable coin as a way to raise, just so they've got a bit more accuracy around what they're raising. Because if they want to raise, say, 10 million, and they do so in ETH, and then something happens in the market and there's 30% drop, they've raised less. And I think a stable coin is a de-risk.
Yeah, and yeah, I can't argue with that. You know, part of my argument was that, you know, when Ethereum launched, no one wanted Ether, right? No one knew what it was. And why would I like force my investor or purchaser to buy Ether when they could just buy Bitcoin, which is a lot more stable and widespread. But over time, as it becomes bigger, I think the volatility settles down a little bit, and Ethereum became eventually an ICO currency, and people kind of are happy with it as it is. But you're absolutely right; the volatility is very stressful for both the buy side and the sell side, and it'll be interesting to see if the stable coins really become the glue that kind of and if that does happen, you can be sure that Polymath will adopt kind of the most reputable ones.
Yeah, it's funny because some of the companies I've met have really not even considered treasury management. And I've met companies that back in 2016 raised a million, and by mid 2017 had like 60 million.
Yeah.
But the opposite has occurred for some people who've raised, you know, 30 million, and at some point they've got 15 million. And treasury management is something I don't think. I mean, I'd never heard of it until I got into the sector, but a lot of these people aren't aware of. And I think that's one of the big risks here for anybody raising funds. I don't think there's a question in that.
Yeah, no, it's a very poignant thing to talk about that because, you know, what do you do? Do you diversify? Do you arbitrarily just invest in other funds that diversify. Do you liquidate to fiat? I think a lot of people rightfully see crypto as really the currency that other things fluctuate against. But in reality, you know, when you're there's tens of millions of dollars on the line going evaporating in a day, that's no way to run a business. And that's scaring away institutional money. I think that's one of the things we want to do with Poly is if you raise your fundraise in Poly, we're encouraging you to be able to liquidate that to fiat right away. We're not going to lock you in the Poly. We're going to say this is a way for you to fundraise. Now you can get US dollars and go on a shopping spree, go invest in startups, go buy real estate, whatever it is you want to do. So we don't want to create friction where it's unnecessary. If you want to liquidate it right away, then volatility is not a big deal. As soon as it comes in, you can liquidate it in real time. And then you've taken that kind of uncertainty off the table.
I've looked also very briefly at T0. I know you're fans of those. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be an exchange for security tokens, as I believe. But will those exchanges also support wider crypto? Like, you know, will you be... Are they? Because I've not looked enough into it. If you were selling your security token on T0, will you be doing it for fiat or would it be for crypto? Do we know that?
Yeah, it's going to be a case by case basis. There's lots of we're on the front lines here, so we see literally I don't want to say dozens, but quite a few emerging security token exchanges. And all that means is that they're a normal crypto exchange, but they also have a license, specifically an ATS license. Which the SEC hands out. So it's just a matter of time, again, that these become functioning and these become kind of widespread. But it's true that right now there's not a lot of liquidity in the security token ecosystem. And that's a huge problem because once you issue all these tokens to investors and you accept their cash, what are they going to do with it, right? It's just kind of sitting there in an address doing nothing. So once these exchanges come online, you'll be able to trade them potentially. And one thing that we're trying to do at Polymath is have our tech integrate directly into the top upcoming security token exchanges. And that way, anyone who launches on Polymath will have the ability to instantly get listed on some of the top exchanges, pending their approval, of course.
I guess it depends on the type of token, though, because if you're buying a token, a share of a piece of art, there is you're holding it as an investment. Whereas if you owned a tokenized share in a business where there's a dividend structure, the liquidity is less important because there's potential return anyway.
Yeah.
And with those, how are dividends expected to be returned? Are they expected to be returned in crypto?
Yeah, you know, that's an evolving question. An answer to that question is, how do you think about those things? Do you buy something and just wait 10 years for it to go up, like a piece of art or even a venture capital fund? Do you have a hybrid where you have like a trading tokenized venture fund where you can LPs can get liquidity early on and it gives access to not well-connected people? I think in terms of dividends, though, we're keeping it simple at the beginning. So for the very first security tokens, it's going to be one token equals one share. And then it's up to the management job, you know, to make sure that they're legally compliant, to make sure that they're paying their dividends correctly. We don't take any onus on kind of the management of what they do. They could take their dollars, buy real estate. The real estate pays cash flow, and then the cash flow buys crypto and pays the token holders a crypto dividend. That's up to the management. Or they could also leave it in crypto, accept the crypto, leave it in crypto, and then treat it as kind of a fund and then return it based on the performance of the fund. So there's lots of different ways you can think about disbursements to investors. And we're excited to see all the different use cases as this thing evolves.
Most of this has come about because of the pressures on SEC and the oversight from SEC. In terms of other markets, are you having to go country by country, market by market, or is it a case of you just focus on what happened in the US? And so, for example, I don't pass the SEC requirements as an accredited investor, but I'm based in the UK. So how do you work in terms of international borders?
Yeah, it's case by case. Again, that the onus on that would rest on the entrepreneur, the issuer launching a token. And it's up to them to figure out kind of two main things. A, where are you domiciled? What jurisdiction are you in as a company? And B, where are your investors from? Because that's what the regulators care about, is protecting their own native, unaccredited retail investors. They want people who are not sophisticated to be protected from unscrupulous issuers. So to answer your question, I think the SEC is the leader. When I say there's a common denominator between all major regulators, it's kind of the SEC leading the charge, and a lot of people follow, including Canada. And they also have the toughest, so it's a great place to start just to be safe, to comply with the SEC. And then there's a good chance you're compliant in other countries as well. But with that said, if you're an issuer and you want to raise money in a certain jurisdiction, you have to get custom local legal advice on how to do that, because there's a lot of variables involved. Does your token have to be locked up, or can it trade instantly? Are you doing kind of like a Reg D or Reg A or Reg S? Are you going to do just a complete full-blown token IPO? So all these different permutations have different regulatory implications, and you need to get kind of custom legal advice for that.
I'm conscious we're going to be running out of time soon. I had so many questions.
Yeah, no, this,
I mean, we can do it again. I do them all in person. So I'll come to, is it Barbados?
Barbados, Toronto. We have lots of offices I think you wouldn't hate. So
I just want to finish out on one thing, which is as a comment. I don't know if you'll comment on it back, but the thing I like most about this is that I've raised capital before for businesses, and you have lots of meetings, and essentially you raise in lumps because you couldn't have enough. You can have meetings to raise small amounts. Yet with here, you can have fractional investors. You can have people investing. You could have someone in Vietnam invest $500, which is the world to them. But it's opening up, I think, investment to lots of people and opportunities they wouldn't normally have. And I expect this will be scary, but an opportunity for traditional venture capital, but also scary.
I absolutely agree. I think, you know, why should only the most connected kind of old boys club on Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley have proprietary access to all the best deal flows? Like, it's unfair. We should have a democratized way for anybody to get access to early stage deals. And part of the challenge with that is, you know, the regulations don't sync with that, because the government doesn't want unaccredited people to have access to early stage deals. They don't want you to invest in Facebook early on. You know, look at Ethereum. Ethereum, if it ever becomes a security retroactively, there's a lot of people who made a lot of money who are just average people. And if they were, you know, deemed unaccredited investors in a unregistered security offering, they would illegitimately have made all that money, and we wouldn't have this kind of ecosystem buzzing like we do. So not to get political at all, but I think it's interesting to think, you know, should we prevent people who just aren't worth $1 million from making their own investment decisions? Obviously, you have to follow the rules. And obviously, too, there's a lot of scammers out there, and the rules do protect people who aren't sophisticated. That's the whole point. So it's an interesting debate. I don't think we'll solve it.
I've met people with more than $1 million who aren't the most intelligent, and I have some really intelligent people who haven't got a lot of money, and it feels like they're very archaic rules. Did they have something to do with the 1920s?
The Securities Act was 1933.
Was it following the 29 crash? I can't remember.
Yeah,
I've read about it.
It was after, as far as I know.
Coming up to 100 years old.
Yeah. And you know, I've softened a bit. You know, I think, to be honest, the regulators have done an amazing job so far. Like, people complain and stuff, but they've let the dust settle. They've let this ecosystem flourish. There's been an unprecedented amount of innovation, and we have nothing to complain about. The only projects they've shut down have been like clear and outright scams and frauds. Mm-hmm. And that's good. And that's what we need. We need referees on the sidelines. I'm not saying we should ever get rid of that. And I think they're open-minded to kind of light touch regulation, self-regulation. It's going to be very interesting to see. The problem is there's so many competing kind of regulatory agencies, the CFTC, the SEC. Is this a currency? Is this a commodity? Is this a, what is it exactly? It doesn't fit in a box. So I used to be very, my eyes would glaze over about regulation, but it does get kind of interesting once you see how crypto kind of interfaces with it. And we're right at the heart of it. How can we, I'll make one more point. You know, a lot of people say, you know, oh, you're launching a security token. What are the regulators going to say? Well, in my experience, they're very open and encouraging of it. They're like, oh, you guys are innovative, you're crypto, but you're also respecting the integrity of our existing legislation. And I think, you know, that's an important point, because the regulators, not only do they want to protect retail investors, but they also don't want to stifle innovation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a dual mandate that they have. And this is a great way for them to kind of walk the middle line by allowing security tokens, encouraging them. On the one hand, it's respecting existing legislation and protecting investors. And on the other hand, it's still allowing some innovation to flourish. So I think this year is going to be the catalyst to when security tokens really take off. The market, you know, 500 million, billion is nothing or whatever it is today. I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. If one New York hedge fund on this street that we're sitting on right now decided to tokenize, it would double the crypto market overnight. So
incredible.
This is still, you know, just a little sliver of even just the US banking system. So I can't wait to see where we go from here.
Great. Well, look, I'm conscious you've got a lot on. If people want to find out more, where should they go and who do you want to hear from and how should they get hold of you?
Polymath.network. We have different channels depending if you're an issuer looking to raise a security token or you're a regulator or a legal professional or a KYC provider. So that's kind of the homepage. My email is on there too for whatever reason. And I appreciate your audience and your time.
Brilliant. Thank you. Great to meet you.
Okay, what did you make of that? Did you enjoy the interview with Trevor? Do you find this project exciting? Are you interested in asset tokenizations and security tokens on the blockchain? I am. I'll be honest, there's still gaps in my knowledge. I don't fully understand regulations. I don't fully understand how Wall Street works, but I'm increasing my knowledge. I'm reading lots and lots more about this, and I will continue to do so because I am interested in this platform. I do see it as an opportunity to raise funds in a different way. So yes, I hope you enjoyed that. Any questions, feel free to email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com and I will try and get back to you. And if you want to support the show, please do leave us a review on iTunes. Please do share it out with your friends and family. And please do follow me on social media. And just a reminder of the other two projects I'm working on. Please head over to openpaper.io if you're interested in the project I'm building there and you want to register for beta access. And please also check out theoutlierpodcast.com, which I'm also working on, and hopefully we'll get the first episode of that out within the next couple of months. Okay, outside of that, I hope you all have a great week and I will speak to you soon.